Welcome to the Dark Zone, an adventure racing podcast.
That was kind of the beginning of our what we felt was our comeback. We just had to get through that bike. And most of the teams we caught were actually on the trek the next day. You could just see people just starting to kind of crumble and break apart. And we were like, okay, now we're in seventh. Now we're in sixth. Okay, now we'll be in fourth. So it was great. We just had really good teamwork and we just kept the gas on.
Okay. You people sit tight, hold the fort, and keep the home fires burning. And if we're not back by dawn, call the president.
You're going the wrong way!
What?
You're going the wrong way!
He says we're going the wrong way!
Oh, he's drunk! How would he know where we're going?
Yeah, how would he know?
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to the Dark Zone Adventure Racing Podcast. This is your host, Brian Gatens. Episode number 82, October 25th, 2023. Adventure Racing World Series World Championship is still going on in South Africa. The winners are in. Teams are still on the course. It's been a fantastic race, and credit to Heidi and Stefan for bringing us such a great show. Today's guest is Mary Chandler. Mary Chandler was a member of Team Viterade, second place finishers at the World Championship this year. Great race they had. She walks us through the whole event. She's, my opinion, she's the best American adventure racer out there. I said it a few times. I'll say it again. I'm happy to say it. Great stuff from her. Want to give a shout out to the New York Adventure Racing Association. NYRA is the sponsor of this podcast today. NYRA brings great races to the New York metro area, including the longest day, their premier race. www.nyra.org, NYARA.org. Thank you to our friends at NYRA for their sponsorship. Some other sponsors are going to pop up in a second. Folks that we love, we're glad you're here. Enjoy Mary. Enjoy the Flash episodes. More to follow in the next few days. Hope you're having a great time watching the World Championships. Keep racing and have a great time. I'd like to also mention the Dark Zone's charity partner, Ascend Athletics. We are proud to support their mission to empower young women through mountaineering-based leadership training and community service. All of our listeners are encouraged to visit ascendathletics.org to learn more about Ascend and their work in helping to develop leadership and resiliency in young women in Pakistan and Afghanistan through fitness, mental health, community service, and mountaineering. Please note that Ascend pays nothing for this mention. We just love the work that they do and are happy to spread the word. Be sure to check out their website for some upcoming activities that anyone can get involved in. We are joined by who I feel to be the best American adventure racer right now, by a mile. Her name is Mary Chandler. She's on Team Viterade, who just came in second in the Adventure Racing World Championship. For those at home, as we set a scene for everybody, it is Wednesday, October 25th. It is 4 o'clock New York, New Jersey time. It is 10 o'clock in Cape St. Francis, South Africa. Mary finished yesterday, came in second place, her team Viterade, had a fantastic, fantastic race, so much going on. Thank you to Abby Perkins, Rootstock Racing, for getting a hold of Mary for me. And Mary's been on the show before, but I couldn't get a hold of her. And Mary's here now in the Dark Zone to talk about her race experience and sort of process it out loud. Mary, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for being on the show. We know that you're kind of still thinking about the race and where you are, but let's start with a nice little bit of a softball question. How does it feel to do so well in the Adventure Racing World Championships?
I'd say it feels amazing right now. We went into this race with certain goals and I'd say we definitely achieved them. And with the field that we had, towing the line was just insane. I knew it would be a battle the whole time. With between like 15 teams, we're capable of going top five easily. And I think that's the first World Champs I've been in where I felt that way. And I was on a team that was very capable of being in that top group.
Can you give us your teammates' names just so the world knows who they are?
Sure. I race with Marco Amsalon. He is from Brazil, but he currently lives in San Diego. Urtzi Iglesia, he is from Spain. He lives a lot of his time in Paraguay because he's the race director of the Expedition Race in Paraguay. And then John Ander, he is from Spain as well.
And you've raced with this team before, correct? This is not the first time you've been with Iterid.
Correct. Alone, even just this year, I did 3 expeditions with them. So, and then in the past, I've done 2 Expedition Oregon. So I guess this was our 5th race together. And I believe out of the 5 races, this was the first one I felt really connected to the team. And I think as a team, we just, everything gelled together, which is what we've been waiting for.
And the gelling obviously came across too with such a high result. And, you know, a big part of the Dark Zone is talking about teamwork and how we work together. And you mentioned how you've done these 5 races previously, and now you've really kind of gelled and the goals came apart and things like that. So clearly it goes without being said that the teamwork factor is a massive part of our sport and holding it together out there. And we'll come to the in-race experience in a moment. But you began by talking about the goals that you had set for the race. What were those goals and how did you determine them as a team? How did that conversation take place before the race?
It's funny because communication is probably our toughest. It's probably our one problem because they all speak Spanish as their first language. Well, I guess Marco is Portuguese, but I have a very hard time communicating with them. So sometimes having those conversations are difficult, but we all went in. Of course, the goal is you want to win. Podium is the second goal. And then, you know, top 5, top 10, like those, you kind of set those in order of what is reasonable and how is the team feeling right now. I went in with the mindset that I thought we were very capable of top 5 and I would be very happy. You know, I knew we'd get top 10 and I just felt like if we could go top 5, I would be super proud of the team. And I knew we were capable of doing that. What the guys individually thought, I honestly don't even know. We're all very similar mindset and have these expectations. When you race on a team that is elite like this, their expectations are very similar. They've done well in the past. They've been as high as 2nd, never world champions. And you know, last race they did, I believe they were 4th in Spain. So, you know, any opportunity at the world champs, you're going for the top position.
Yeah, and so there were things that clearly did not have to be said because if you've raced with them before 5, you know, the multiple times before, going on the fact that who these racers are, they're the elite, a word that completely applies to them. So therefore you knew going into it, it was going to be full guns right away on the course, go, 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 moving as fast as you can. Want to call out early in the podcast, congratulations to the Swedish Armed Forces adventure team. I mean, Safit just had a resounding victory in number 1. Not to take away from the efforts of Iterid, and we'll walk you through your race in a second, and I'm sure you'll fill in some blanks for me and I'll fill in some blanks for you as we kind of go through all of this. The course itself, you know, this was the first adventure racing world championship held in Africa, Cape St. Francis Resort, the Eastern Cape as they call it. Big course, 800 kilometers, basically a point-to-point race, crossed over itself once, but there was no way really to go. When you knew this was going to be big, right? Heidi and Stefan Muller had talked about the course being as big as it was going to be. They didn't back down one bit from telling the world about it, that they were really going to bring a major event to the adventure racing community. And clearly with 109 teams, big turnout, a whole spectrum of racers. So you knew going in it was going to be big. When you saw those maps and they give out the first and you got the course preview and you understood it, how did the size of the course impact the team? Were you excited for it? Were you trepidatious about it? Like what were your team thoughts about that?
Well, our first thought was we were figuring out how would the Dark Zone affect us. We didn't have much information before the race. We knew there was going to be one, but we didn't know at what point. And in the past, Dark Zones have easily can cut off front pack from the second pack. But I've also had enough experience in these where I have caught teams that have gotten through the Dark Zone. Or, you know, I was on a team, we had a 24-hour lead in a race once. We still blew it because we didn't do the end of our race correctly. So basically, you got to factor in where's the Dark Zone at and do we push hard so that we can rest there? Or do you get to the Dark Zone, expect to rest and then race hard? It's just, there's so many factors. I think also the third trekking leg was longer for all the teams than expected. So when we were trying to figure out our hours and planning, Stefan had provided fast expected times. And usually those are fairly accurate for the first few legs of a race. And then everyone's wheels start to fall off. But, his expected times put us at the Dark Zone night 2, like basically giving us a few hours of sleep before we got on the paddle, which would be it, you know, on paper, that sounds amazing and perfect, especially with racing with Vita, right? They don't like to sleep. So being forced to stop and sleep to wait for the river to open and having the rest of the lead teams there was sounding like a great plan. But the rest of the course, you know, three long, long bike legs, and this team can ride. We can push the bikes. We can make it work. So nothing really scared us. If anything, we thought this race may have favored to our strengths.
Got it. And so clearly, you know, and as for the beginner racer at home, for these big races, and it happens in other races too, not just the multi-days, is that very often the race director will put out a schematic long before the race, and the schematic breaks down the legs, the approximate distances. It doesn't get into the maps themselves, but it gives you a sense of sort of plan. So anybody racing the World Champs had a chance to see that schematic and begin to think about it. And then what everybody does is they begin to think about their estimated time of travel and then how it's going to impact it. The dark zone we're going to come to in a second. I want to get there, but let's walk you through the bit of how your race started. Obviously, the teams were transported, 11 o'clock start in the morning. Started with a big trek with a significant beach trek based on it, as well as a couple of river crossings. How did that early hot stage, especially with such a long time on the beach, many, many Ks, how did that impact the team going into the race?
So our plan was just to go out and hang with the lead, but I don't know what happened at checkpoint two. Next thing I know, we're like going off into the bush, off the trail, getting stabbed by all these thorns. And meanwhile, the rest of the racers seemed to stay on this trail. And it was almost as if Chris Warren did the same thing. It was almost as if these good navigators were trying to make the opening leg harder than it was. I don't know. I didn't ask questions, but I was just like, what is going on? Eventually, Ertz, you know, our navigator, sorted it out. And we got back in the rhythm, but we were probably like in 80th place. And so then it was this long, you know, conga line of people on the single track that we had to pass and hopefully not be jerks about it. And we were just trying to get ourselves back up to the front. So that was a little unexpected because we had to really push hard to gain the ground that we lost in just a I don't know, just kind of a crazy minor error, I guess.
And to your point, you're used to being in the front. Like usually, like Viterade really is never really sitting in 80th place. So all of a sudden you had this weird thing happen in the beginning, kind of throws you off the game a little bit. And now you're playing catch up and you're passing teams. And if you remember when the trackers we had at that point, you could see lines and lines of teams on top of each other. The navigation wasn't that hard, but you were expecting to be in the pointy end.
But when you have 109 teams of four people, that is a long line of people to pass where there's no passing lane. So it was like, it was just crazy. And I saw all of my American friends. Which is fantastic. I just got to say hi to everyone as we ran by them. And they're all like confused why we came from the back. But I don't know. It was entertaining, but also very stressful because it was also getting very hot. And I could feel like we cannot blow ourselves up just because we made a small mistake in the first hour. I mean, it's just stupid, but at the same sense, you're so caught up in the moment that it makes you want to, you know, take charge and get back to where we belong. So the heat did start to take a toll on me and that push of just nonstop running for the first probably opening 3-4 hours before we got kind of settled into a rhythm. Ertz took my pack for a couple hours just to let me cool down and that seemed to help. And then by the time we got to the dunes, I felt back to normal and felt great. And the dunes were unreal. You just pop into this oasis. You feel like you're, I don't know, Tatooine. It was just insane. And you can know nothing for miles. And the winds, you know, the wind's blowing sand and it's just covering tracks. And so you couldn't, sometimes you could follow tracks, sometimes you couldn't, but it was pretty beautiful.
You know, it's funny, if I was in a race and you were in the race, if I saw you coming up behind me, I would think that you were lapping me. I wouldn't think that you were actually falling behind me in that race. And so interesting dynamic in the beginning, right? You're full of energy. You're full of all these things going on. All of a sudden you're in this weird upside down. You have to kind of hold it together, make up the distance, and the heat being the heat. You had those two river crossings in the beginning that gave the team members some trouble. That was the current I heard was strong, but everybody came through there fine. After that first stage, you then get on your bike and you had a pretty significant bike leg in front of you. How did you find the on-course riding, the terrain, the elevation, and then how did Ertz do on the navigation? Because I will tell you this, and I definitely want to call out all the armchair dot watchers. There were people that were commenting on how, people in their homes, by the way, were commenting on how it seemed that it was easy navigation for the race. And clearly World Champion, not easy navigation. How did you all do managing that?
I'd have to ask Ertz directly that. There was only a couple of issues that he kind of faltered, and nothing massive. He never seemed like confused. He said sometimes the trails didn't quite line up, but on the bike, it seemed, I guess from my side opinion, it seemed pretty straightforward. We didn't have to stop at all. He can switch his maps. I mean, we have like, I don't know, 20 maps in a leg, mm-hmm. and he can switch his maps while riding. So the only time we ever actually stopped and put a foot down was to get a checkpoint. So he just was like a machine. He just pushed through and made the turns, and, you know, I don't know. He nailed it. And whether it was difficult or not, I couldn't tell you that.
How did you find the condition of the roads?
Biking legs. What's that?
How did you find the condition of the roads?
For the most part, I don't remember any incidents. I heard Strong Machine had a guy crash on their bike, which is unfortunate, but I don't remember. I guess there was some downhill craziness here and there. But for the most part, I thought the roads were pretty rideable.
Yeah, that's our friend Evan from Strong Machine. I want to wish Evan, by the way, best of health. Yep.
Yeah. But you know, and then when we did get some rain at one point in the course, and then of course that makes it sloppy for a little bit and slippery, but overall I thought the roads were pretty nice.
And clearly,
but maybe I've done too many yet.
Yeah. And when you're moving at that, when you say you were running and you were cycling, what speed, if for the person at home, how fast do you think you were going during those parts?
So when we took off on the bike, I know I was keeping an eye on the odometer, and we were pace lining about 24K an hour, pretty okay. comfortable. It was fairly flat, nothing crazy. And it just got us going on the TA. I think we caught like two teams within the first 10K. And we were talking to one of the Swedes from another team, and she said when we went by, she's like, she thought we were on a different type of road surface. She's like, she didn't understand how we went by so fast.
Yeah,
and they were like fighting the road. So maybe it was more rocky. I don't know. I don't remember.
We are talking to the number two team in the world, right? So let's recognize the fact that what is easier, if you will, relative term for you guys, is a lot harder, because what we were feeling from the we were reading from the folks on the ground, and we were reading online that it was relatively challenging terrain. Yeah, that it was hard, it was rocky. And you know, we mentioned Evan, glad he's doing better, took a big tumble and his collarbone is no longer in one piece, and there's all of that going on. But Vitorade is Vitorade for a reason, right? And you were passing teams, the idea of you being on a different road is a good way of saying it. After that bike, you went into that trek. Now, in the trek you went into, the Dark Zone was going to follow, right? This race had one big paddle on it. On that paddle was going to be an overnight Dark Zone, and that teams were crushing themselves to make it to the Dark Zone. I think you said earlier that you thought maybe you were not going to make the Dark Zone and get a few hours rest and then start it in the morning. How did that?
Right.
How did the looming Dark Zone impact your speed, and then how did you do on that trek that led up to it?
Well, that trek had a predicted fast time that I think nobody was even close to it. So it went slower than expected, which kind of threw us off a little bit. I guess I was told by a couple of different people who were dot watching said our route was a little different than some of the other teams, but you know, nothing major, but everyone had different routes. It was very technical off trail stuff that you're trying to not trip on. You know, you can't really get a run in because the brush is like, you know, knee high and there's rocks and things. But we were all getting sleepy, and it was night two. And so we decided, this is stupid. We're just kind of like stumbling drunk around here. So we took a 30-minute rest. And Ben had also done the same thing, because they, when we were getting up from our nap, they had came trekking by. So they had taken a nap earlier. And then we thought we felt great, and we kept going. And then all of a sudden we were all like staggering again. And so we decided to take another 30-minute nap. And then we were worried that we just blew our opportunity to possibly catch that Dark Zone. But I think in the end, had we not taken those, we would have been even further away from making it.
Well, that's the balance, right? That's the balance between the, you know, how often do you rest? Do you not rest? Things like that. And to your point, the idea of stumbling around like drunk, right? The idea like it's nighttime, it's the second night, you've been on the go, and you have to work those rests in there. And you mentioned that Vitorade is not a big fan of sleeping, right? And clearly we've seen in races where teams have not rested have fallen apart down the road. You were able to make it onto the water before the Dark Zone went into effect, but the rule that was in effect in the race was that when the time came and it got dark, you had to pull off the river and you had to take a sleep until the sun came up in the morning. It was not lost upon the dot watching world that the expectation was to lay down by the side of the river, but we could clearly tell through the gift of GPS technology that you appeared to find a barn of some sort, a big sleep. How did that work out for Vitorade?
Yeah, that worked out fantastic, but it wasn't planned. We got through three of the five portages, knew we weren't going to, you know, we had to get through five before you were allowed to paddle at night. We got through the third one and it was like 10 to seven. We're like, let's not get back in the water. We were freezing cold. Marco and I had both had a little swim upriver. We flipped in one of the rapids. So, and then it was a headwind down the river. So, I mean, it was just insane. You just felt so cold. And so when we got out and we're just staying there trying to figure out what can we do, the only option was to keep moving. And so we left our boats and we needed to warm up. And so we thought we would just trek until we could find something. And yes, the rule was said that we had to stay near the river, but it wasn't, I mean, wasn't very specific. And it wasn't in that moment, that was not an option for us. We were so shaky and so ridiculously frozen that we had to move and keep going. And if we were, you know, if we were a team that felt we were purposely breaking a rule, then what, you leave your tracker at the boat, right? But we didn't. We kept our tracker because we really felt like we were doing nothing wrong. And if we did have a problem with one of us going hypothermic, we needed our tracker. So we kept it with us and we saw a light off in the distance because it had just gotten dark, and we went for it. And I think it took us like 20, maybe 30 minutes, but we were also, you know, slow, shivery walking. But at least by the time we arrived, we were coherent enough to talk to the owner and say, hey, we just need a barn or a place to get out of the wind for the night. And they were more than happy to allow us to shelter. And then, yes, we spent some time being worried that that maybe we did break a rule. But again, if I had to do it again, I would do it again. It's just in that moment we needed to get away from the river and we needed to warm up.
Yeah. And we were, and to your point, the idea that the penalty was a 2-hour penalty, right? That was the consequence. You paid for it. And when you balance the idea of the 2-hour penalty versus the health benefit and the safety benefit of where you went, it makes complete sense, right? It wasn't a disqualification. It wasn't a massive multi-hour penalty. And so to your point, the fact that it was, you were so cold, because while that was going on, the teams that were behind you were to the west. And as a result of being to the west, they were the entire trek, all the teams were all over the farmhouses. When you go back and you take a look at the track, if you look at it, there were like 8, 9, 10 teams in these different farmhouses. And we were kind of laughing, watching the dots, saying that some poor farmer is like, holy cow, it's Christmas morning and everybody's showing up here at my house. And we've heard stories, to credit to the South African people, that the level of acceptance and level of fun and the level of just what can we do for you is time and time again. The Springbok Zambonis have this great video of how they stopped by a bakery and they had a walk-in huge oven that they were allowed to stand inside in their underwear to warm up, which I've never heard of before. And Springbok Zambonis, your invite to be on the show is coming because you were a fascinating team to follow. Other teams talk about they went in someone's house and the rugby match was on. And they sat and they had food and they were with a random person, a farmer, watching the rugby match, right? So that's adventure racing. So this is the taste that you got. How long was your sleep in that area? It was a pretty long time you had a chance to lay down.
Yeah, well, so we had 10 hours off the clock. By the time we walked and found a place that we were comfortable to shelter in, and, you know, you get your bivvies out or whatever and try and get into dry clothes, I think we finally laid down by about 8:30. And then we knew we needed some time to walk all the way back in the morning. So I think we were up by 3 or 3:30 in the morning. So it was almost 7 hours of sleep, which is pretty solid. But the friendliness and just every country but America opens their door to anyone knocking on it and says, come in and take this. Yeah. Let me make this. Watch rugby with me. It's just, we are so paranoid, and I know this, but I don't realize it until I race and I see these things that go on. These people are so welcoming. Yeah. There's a random group of four sopping wet people. Yes, please come in my house.
You're right. It's we had that. We raced in Ecuador. We had an injured teammate and two teams had come together and Luis Bekdak, who's still on the course, by the way, Luis is out there right now racing with Team Disability. We were just in someone's barn and the owner came out and actually their garage, and Luis explained what was going on there. And like, no problem at all, went back into their house. And so I do agree with you that when you do the international races, you get that sense, and it's a interesting dynamic, and it compares to how, as Americans, how we approach that. And that's not to say, for the listening audience out there, we have many, many stories of being welcome in American homes, but it happens a bit easier and faster in other countries. And so you're spot on about that. So here's the $1,000 question, Mary, that when you had this big 7-hour sleep deep in a race, other teams are down the river, they've made it through the dark zone, and now you had this huge rest. How do you feel that rest played a role in how you did from that section of the race to coming in second, or were there other factors that played a role too? Like your feet, your navigation, your food, your other rest. Like how did that benefit you when you went, when the race continued after that big sleep?
Exactly. It was the combination of all that. Like it makes you, makes us rethink our sleep strategy, right? Just taking a big rest in the middle, our feet fully recovered. And yeah, we had been paddling, but they were still sopping wet that whole time paddling. So in 7 hours, they actually dried out and felt great. We knew we had big sections of the race left to come. Our legs, everything, you know, the swelling went down. We ate what we could, you know, you take some ibuprofen, whatever, you take care of yourself. And then we all gave ourselves a little pep talk that, hey, let's take advantage of being forced to sleep. And when in the morning, when we get up, we rally and we just go for it and see what happens to it. Cause we've all been in the position that those lead teams were, which was push until you break. And, you know, I don't wish that on anybody, but when you're in our position, we were, we were kind of hoping that would work for us, was, which would be to just get out there, hammer, which is what this team is capable of doing, and then see how it comes apart in the end.
So there's two things worth pointing out there for folks as they're going through this. And first is that there's a physical part of it too. I got great advice one time. My feet were just my enemy for a very, very long time. And doing specific things to help my feet out played a huge role in later races. But one thing you did well that we always talk about to the newer racer is that every chance, every time you have a chance to get your feet dry, get them dry. That, you know, shoes off, socks off, feet up, get them by if there's some fire nearby, anything, get yourself dry. Cause it's like resetting your feet the next day, right? Unless you have an actual injury going in your foot, you really feel much better. And the second thing was psychological is that at that point, you knew that teams had made it through. I'm assuming that teams made it through the dark zone. And now all of a sudden you were the hunter and they were the hunted. And knowing that somebody's up the road is always a natural spur psychologically. What other factors played a role in your strong, in like, talk about your nutrition a little bit. Like how well did your team eat? Did you respond well to what you found along the way? Did you pack a lot of your own food? How did that come together for you?
I wouldn't say our nutrition was that great, but we did every TA, we made a point to get a meal. And I think that helps. Usually I'm not a big fan of sitting down and eating in a TA, but in this case, with how long the legs were and how worked we came in at the end of each leg, it made sense to just go grab food, which was very easy to grab, purchase, whatever. We grabbed it, we ate it while we TA'd. And then when we left, we were full. Like we were, our bodies were recovered and, you know, and you had some real food in you with some real calories. And then when we get out there, it's very hard to eat when you're pushing as hard as we were. So our actual nutrition during the race, I think, was a little limiting, but we did do a lot of drinks with calories in them, which is easier, goes down in gels, which also I'm not usually a fan of, but for this race, it worked because you just couldn't, you know, really spend much time eating. You had to just always hands on the brakes and push.
Gotcha. And such a big race like this, you weren't able to blow through transitions. I mean, obviously you went quickly through transitions, but the idea of you would stop, you would eat, you'd reset yourself and go back out another hundreds of kilometers and then that next leg. How did the weather impact you? You know, one thing we saw in this race was incredible swings in temperature, right? We would see it. We had a hot day on the dunes down to 40 degrees Fahrenheit at night with the wind. How did you manage your thermoregulation?
For us, I think we were quite lucky for the most part. We only had the worst weather as well. We happened to be paddling, I guess. So that's not lucky, but it sounds like the people who were in the canyon trying to do the abseil and other ones got caught in torrential downpours. Whereas when the rain hit us, we were coming into the TA right before two before the paddle. And we just threw our jackets on and kept moving. As long as you're moving, we were fine. But it did set up for a very cold night of paddling and, you know, trying to, like, again, which is why we decided to leave the river. It just made no sense to try and make that work.
Yeah. And a shiver sleep's not going to help you. Laying by the river, just as cold could be. And you make a good point that when the bad weather arrived, all those teams to your west that were on the trek had to seek shelter inside. And all the teams were on the river would have a really hard time. And not many teams bivvied on the side of the river that night. The other nights they followed. A lot of teams got caught out those next following nights. You're right about that. Come off the river, get on the bike. You have a huge stage ahead of you. Now you begin to catch teams. How did that feel?
On that bike, it was the big bike. It was pretty quiet, but we were pretty we set ourselves into a pace line. I think our average was like 19K for the 220 or what or so kilometers. So we had a pretty solid pace line going. It just worked really well as a team. I think there were six checkpoints. We literally only stopped six times to basically when we stopped at a checkpoint, that's when you ate, took care of whatever you needed to do. We did have two stops at a gas station for grabbed a Coke and found some great meat pies. But other than that, we were very efficient. We didn't stop. We didn't waste any time. There wasn't a lot of talking. It was head down, suck it up and go. And someone was always taking the lead and pushing the pace. And we were like a train. It was fantastic. And we knew when we came in that we had had a good ride. We didn't see anybody until we got to the TA and then found out Ben was still there sleeping. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. So that kind of went, oh, all right, this is starting to work. We just gained back like 10 hours on a team.
Gotcha.
So, that was kind of the beginning of what we felt was our comeback. We just had to get through that bike. And most of the teams we caught were actually on the trek the next day. You could just see people just starting to kind of crumble and break apart. And we were like, okay, now we're in seventh. Now we're in sixth. Okay, now we'll be in fourth. So it was great. We just had really good teamwork and we just kept the gas on.
We did a couple of flash podcasts during the race. And you might hear them down the road if you want to listen to them on the flight home. Brent Friedland of Rootstock Racing was one of the guests. He was on both of them. And at the end of the first flash podcast, when we were discussing the race, he actually called out, keep an eye on Viterate. Like he was an early adopter of the big sleep, fast strategy, off we go. To your credit, psychologically, you went through that big, long bike. You really didn't see a whole lot of people. And so for all you know, they could be, they had a 10-hour jump on you. You didn't know where they were. And then you come across and you saw Ben, obviously, in the TA. A listener was, I was chatting with a listener not too long ago, and they were asking about the idea of motivation. And what motivates people in those big moments, in those races when it's head down, work hard? Are you focusing psychologically? Like, is your attention all focused on the immediate moment of holding it together, then eating, food, drinking, or is your attention focused on what you hope to find down the road in terms of we're going to get somebody, we're going to catch somebody? Like, what drives you and the team to move so quickly at that point? Is it the current moment or is it the future of what you're going to get as a result of the effort?
Well, that's a tough question. I'd say like for me, it was push hard and just take it piece by piece. And like when we get to the TA, we'll get more information and maybe we'll see some teams. But yes, if you get in any sort of eyesight of another team there, that's instant motivation. If you can see red blinky lights off in the distance, you go after them. I don't know. That's a tough question. It was kind of unspoken with us. We just went for it. We knew if we wanted to make up our dark zone, we just had to do it. We had to push hard, be efficient and try and get any minute we could. I mean, just stopping one less time versus another team, will give us like five more minutes back, maybe riding 2K per hour. I was doing the math. I was trying to do the math out there and it was like 2K per hour faster than another team over however many kilometers was like, we could gain back 5 hours. So it's just amazing that, what you can make yourself do to get the job done.
And what's interesting about that too, is that the fact that the leg was so long, it gave you all the more time and distance to catch them, right? In a shorter race, shorter leg, if they're further down the road on you, it's tough for you to get to them. But because it was such a long leg and so much going on down the road, you were getting there. You mentioned that you saw a bend in the TA, and this was a transition from the big bike to the trek. People, when they discuss adventure racing, are always confused by like what teams know, what they don't know, who's behind, who's in front. But you see bicycles in TA, you see other, like you are able to sort of gather data from just by observing what's going on in a TA in regards to where you stand in the race. But having seen Ben in the transition area and then knowing the race was ahead of you, was there any conversation on the team about like, we're doing great, we're not doing great, keep going, keep hunting? Or was it just unspoken, quick transition, get a meal and get rolling? Or did you have a sense of where you were in the race?
For the most part, it was unspoken, but there was also some smiling going on amongst ourselves when we found out that they were there sleeping. Like basically we knew our hard work had worked for at least one team, right? We had one team back in our sights. Whereas when we started that morning, we thought we were, 10 hours behind, sixth place on up. So it gave us a little push and a little reward, basically knowing that what we had just done all night long actually worked. And here's our first victim of our push, was that these guys, I mean, we had no idea how long they had been there. For all we know, they had been sleeping for 6 hours, but they were there, and that's what mattered. And because we were still feeling amazing, we didn't need to sleep. Unfortunately, we had to wait for our bike boxes because the bike truck had had an issue or something. But they, of course, they gave us the time credit, but it also gave us more time of understanding, you know, how well we were doing and what was happening in the race.
Gotcha. Where was the team at this point physically? Being on the bike is better on your feet, but there's still some fatigue there of being hunched over, your back, your shoulder, your neck. How was everybody feeling going into transition 7? Was everyone kind of holding it together, or were the aches of pain starting to kick in?
No, I think everyone was surprisingly, amazingly felt great. Maybe we were riding our high from just having such a clean, fast bike ride, but we came in pretty amped up, and then we couldn't even, like, we had an opportunity to basically take a nap because we had to wait for our gear, but we couldn't. We got some food. We're just kind of chilling out. There was some furniture. We threw our bivvies on, and we just kind of relaxed and we're just, I don't know, kind of enjoyed each other just hanging out calmly, like waiting for the next section of the race to go.
What was the reaction of the team when you realized you'd have to wait for that hour and 40 minutes? You had to wait for as long as you had to wait. You knew there'd be a time credit and you had the penalty kicking around. What psychologically, how does that impact the team in terms of hurry, hurry, hurry? Now we have to wait. Do you just go into recovery mode, shoes off, socks off, get some food and wait? Or do you talk about keeping each other motivated? Or are you worried about the energy draining out of you?
On this team, I'd say half the team got a little bit worked up and was like, what do you mean our bike's not here? We need to keep going. And the other half of us were like, oh, this is like, we get a little break. We're basically forcing ourselves to have a comfortable TA right now because there's nothing we can do. So, I think it took a couple minutes to process like, hey guys, this is okay. This is not going to affect us. You know, let's take advantage of another situation where we're forced to stop. Take care of your feet, get your socks and shoes off, right? Like we talked, get them dry. And when our gear is here, boom, we're out. So in the end, I think, you know, it was another little like a bonus of free time that, we were given to, you know, not at our fault, but, just from the race organization having some trouble getting the trailer in, it is amazing for them logistically to move the amount of gear that they moved and with the separation of the teams.
Oh yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
We were with the folks of us who were at home, we were screenshotting the tail of the race from the front of the race to the people who were struggling towards the back, and logistics and the moving and the 400 teams and the bikes. And to credit to Stefan and the race that they put together and Heidi and just managing everybody going on here and just all sort of things like that. I'm looking forward. It's great talking to you, Mayor. Don't get me wrong, but I cannot wait to speak to the race crew that put the scale of this race together. I mean, I feel, and I'll let the experts talk more about it. This to me feels like one of the biggest adventure races ever. In terms of the size of the teams, the size of the course. You know, we talk a lot about Fiji and the TV show in Patagonia, but to have these hundreds of people in the support crew and all the gear that had been moved around, it felt very smooth from those of us watching from home. There was, of course, there's hiccups everywhere. You had to wait for your gear. But at the end of the day, what a credit to the race that Expedition Africa put on. Oh, my goodness.
Well, and I mean, the media presence, like it's been so fun now that I'm back in civilization to go back and see what you all were talking about while we were out there and what you guys were, you know, planning or you know, what you were predicting would happen amongst the teams and what was actually going on. Because when we were out there, we have no idea what other dots are doing. We have no idea that Estonia and France and the Swedes were, you know, changing hands so many times. It's not till after the race when we can actually talk to each other where we get those stories.
And that's what drives the racing, right? It's all the stories that we tell each other.
Yeah. So yeah, the media, everything, the volunteers. I mean, some of those guys, they were, those bike boxes somehow get heavier and heavier as the race goes on with our wet gear always goes in those. And so I actually had to help load one of the trucks because they were so frustrated trying to get these bike boxes that were just like exploding with gear. But they, you know, they did it and they got it done. And I'm sure they got less sleep than we did.
So you had a very, very good, come out of 7, you had a great trek. The canyon was taken off the race, obviously, because of the fear of the water and the flash floods in there. You had to adjust to that. Talk to us about when you passed Team Estonia, that you knew that, like, what was that moment like? Did you see the daytime, nighttime? Did you see the headlights in the distance? Like, what was that? Did you see them at all? Did you know you passed them? Or like, how did your race unfold there?
So they left the TA about one. We were surprised when we came in the last TA that they were even there. And then we had to take our penalty there for sleeping away from the river. So they got up and left, and I think they had maybe a 40-minute head start on us. And then we just did what we do. You get into your zone, and we started working, and we're going to start ticking off these checkpoints. And at one point we were on this road, like this trail, and you could hear talking kind of below us, and we got really quiet, and we figured it was Estonia because we couldn't quite understand what they were saying, and they'd be the only team out here. But we also knew that the French were somewhere. So it was kind of like a mystery of what was going on out there. And because I wasn't looking at a map, I had no idea like where we needed to be, and you know, why would there be a team right below us? And so it was kind of a mystery, but all we could do is just keep pushing and hope that things would line up and maybe we'd actually see them and pass them, or maybe we already passed them. It was crazy out there.
And when you finished and you came across and you were sitting there, did you know where you finished? How did you find out that you came in second? First off, stop, answer yourself. Where did you think you were in relation to the race? And when you found out you were second, how did that work out for you?
Personally, I kind of thought we may have been second because we were watching footprints in the sand, and like, you know, the wind was blowing pretty hard, but like for a team that should have been only like anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes ahead, we should have still seen some evidence of their tracks. And we just weren't seeing that. And, you know, of course the Swedes' tracks were pretty much gone. Every once in a while we'd see some. But yeah, I was watching the ground, I think, because my head was down so much. I was kind of pushing so hard, but I kind of had a feeling. I don't know. It just felt like Ertzi's nav. We only had one little bobble, I think, and he sorted it out. And the way we almost like, I still don't know what exactly happened there, but when we stumbled onto the checkpoint, there was like no evidence that anybody had been there. So I just kind of know. I just kind of felt like we had moved up into second somehow. And because I had also heard at the last TA that possibly France had missed a checkpoint with somebody there, but you know, that doesn't change our race plan at all because we didn't know the story and we were still going for it. So I guess technically we assumed we were third, but to be rewarded with second or awarded second, was kind of a surprise, but due to the French missing a checkpoint.
Yeah, that's an interesting, we were talking about that before, and the, you know, for years, when Stefan put his races on, the expectation was that teams would mark their own map, right? You get a blank map and then there's a master map and you go and you have to circle where the checkpoint is. And team 400, the French team, had a really, they had CP26 did them in very early on. And that we found out later on the race that impacted them and that took them out of the standings because for those at home, if you miss a checkpoint, you get relegated behind everybody who caught every single checkpoint. On the checkpoint question and the challenges there, when you look at the 70 plus checkpoints we had out there, how much searching did you have to do? If your memory serves you, how long did you have to look for any one single checkpoint? Did you spend a half an hour out there, or did Ertzi pretty much bring you to every checkpoint every time?
No. Yeah. Ertzi pretty much nailed within the range. Maybe we had to kind of look around for 5 minutes max, but really other than the one out on the dune, I think it was 75. That was the only one we spent the most time on. And it was just the trails were kind of crazy in there. We were using some old trails. Then we ended up in this crazy 100-meter bush bash of stuff that was up to our neck. And you'd pop out just enough to see the dune ahead, and knowing that was your goal was open sand dune. And then you'd be back underneath the brush and then you'd pop back up. And so like that, I felt like we were losing a lot of time, but at that point we had to commit to it. And the fastest travel was still to get out of the shrubs and things and get onto the sand. And it was beautiful. There's this beautiful lake that was in the middle of the sand dunes. And of course that wasn't on the map. And you know, dunes change so much with the wind. So like other than the vegetation, I don't think anything really lined up for where we even popped out at. So it was just a matter of Ertzi sorting it out. And we, decided to, you know, change our direction, head back where we kind of came from. And there, all of a sudden we crested this dune and we could see it off in the distance. So, it was pretty interesting out there.
Yeah, clearly the Ertzi and his navigation and teams get into a flow eventually, right? I Eric Carvalho, who's a master navigator from Pack Rafting Adventures, he always says that the hardest checkpoint to find is the first one. And then once you get into that flow and you start moving and you get a sense of the maps and the kilometers and all of that, then you're able to move quicker down the trail, held it together I'm looking at the tracker right now. Swedish Armed Forces came in first, and we'll get them on the show. We're trying to work with them. They're sleeping. God bless them. 118 hours was their total race time. 118 hours. Viterade, you guys were 124. Not exactly, but in terms of there's some other numbers there, but 124 is your race time, and Estonia was 127. Obviously, the minutes play a role there too, but clearly a very, very close race when you think about over 100 hours of racing altogether. When you factor in the river sleep and you factor in your other sleeps, how many hours do you think you slept the entire race?
I'd say 8.5, because we did 2 half-an-hour sleeps on night 2, then we did the 7 hours, and then we did 1 30-minute sleep on the last bike, and that was it.
You went all the way through.
Which, again, goes back to the whole, when you get a solid race in the middle like that, it was like stage 2. It was like we restarted the race, and you know, had we had another day of racing, we would have needed a sleep for sure. But I also really feel like the way the team was still feeling, we could have, I mean, we brought that gap down to 6 hours with the Swedes. And you just never know.
Yeah. Sleep is the superpower in many ways. And there's this interesting dynamic where people kind of, they clobber themselves with the lack of sleep, but then you see later on the race, they have a hard time, and it's tough to nail that. So I find it fascinating that you had that forced sleep for so long there in relatively comfortable conditions, which was good for you. And that kind of reset you, and it took care of your body, took care of your stomach and all of that. It's now 10:45 at night in South Africa, Mary. And I know that you're tired. You're very gracious with your time. And so I'm going to let you go in just a moment. I started off by saying that you are the best American adventure racer right now. And I don't think that's hyperbole. I think that's very true. When you think about the sport and what the sport does to you and how much you enjoy it and why you go through all these things, a lot of people who are new to the sport listen into the Dark Zone. I get a lot of email over time that when people are training, they'll put an episode on and they'll just like use the hour long 45 as sort of their training background noise in their head. So knowing that the newer racer is out there, knowing that the newer racer hears you and hears second in the world and hears best American adventure racer, what do you think someone right now who's starting, who's getting into the sport, what should they be doing right now to get incrementally better at being an adventure racer? What has worked for you, and what advice would you give to them?
First of all, let's maybe call me the oldest, fastest adventure racer right now. I don't think I'm the best. But for me, actually, which kind of plays with what it is for me, it's experience. I have done over 50 of these expedition races. I'm still trying to get it right. You learn so much about yourself. You learn so much about how to push through the pain. So like how hard we were pushing, the riding we did on the last ride had so much vertical. I was impressed that I don't know what was keeping us on our bikes. It was just amazing that your mind can tell you, nope, keep going. My teammate Marco, he had he had some lower leg pain, and it was so hard to watch him push himself so hard for us. He was in so miserable, like he couldn't get off his bike. So like if we came to a gate, which there are so many gates, he'd just balance himself and I would come up and I'd just hold him so he didn't have to unclip. We'd get the gate open and then he'd push on. And if he did have to pop off his bike, then John Ander would get off and like run alongside him, kind of like they do in the tour when they get they swap a tire and they get their rider going again. It was just amazing to see the kind of suffering that you can make yourself do when you're willing to. And if you can, get your brain to outnumber your body. So for me, I think experience has definitely helped, but I guess now that I don't even know where we're going with the question now, I lost it. But like,
by the way, it was 118, 124 hours of racing. Yeah, you're allowed to lose the thread. You're doing fine.
But yeah, it's just, and having the right teammates around you and finding what works for you. Everybody is different and everybody needs different things. And, when I've raced with so many people, I know the signs of a teammate that needs, maybe they need a Snickers bar, pick me up, or maybe they need a little nap or just a hug or something. But, the more races you do, the more, you learn these things. And that's kind of the key. And I respect the people who can jump into an expedition race who have never done one before, but it's also kind of crazy to me. I feel like you're almost setting yourself up for not failure, but like not really having a good time for your first race. Like starting out with those shorter ones, learning things. I mean, even going from daylight to darkness is like a whole nother world, right? Especially for your navigator. And learning to deal with any random thing that pops up along the way. Like all of a sudden we're in a torrential downpour. What do? You know, do we quit? Do we find shelter? Do we just, you know, throw our jacket on and keep moving because it'll pass? It's all those combination of things that, that have made me, I feel, successful, and my teammates around me who have taught me so much as I've raised so much.
And I think you're right there, Marin. We're going to wrap it up here. The idea of experience, right? That takes care of a lot. It's good to jump into a big race, but don't suffer too much. Be a good teammate and just be there for each other. And Mary, clearly you were there for Viterade. Viterade was there for you. We are delighted. We are delighted at your result of second place at the World Championship. We are big fans of yours here at the Dark Zone. We appreciate your time. Enjoy your time in South Africa. Eat a lot, sleep a lot, and we look forward to speaking to you soon. Thank you again, Mary.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another episode of The Dark Zone. Thank you to Mary Chandler for being a guest. She's been on previously. Go back in our catalog and find her other episodes. She is fantastic. Always good to have Mary on the show. Thank you for being a listener. Thank you for being here. The Dark Zone is there for the listener. We appreciate your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions. Brian@ardarkzone.com. Thanks for being a listener. Keep racing and be safe.